Taylor Swift is an industry, right? You could have that. And if you don't believe in yourself to your core, if you're afraid of who you are and afraid of what you can do and afraid of what your value is, you will always be chasing it.
You are now listening to the Music Business Dreams podcast, brought to you by KDMR Music.
Welcome back to the Music Business Dreams podcast, the podcast that teaches you how to succeed in the music business. I am your host, Brandon Jackson from KDMR Music, and I'm super excited to have you here for episode 14. Now, today we spoke with Sam Fisher. He's an artist manager, and that's who you just heard a little bit from before the intro. And it was a little bit of a long conversation, so I'm not going to make it even longer with a bunch of announcements. We're going to get right into it. But first, I do have to announce the winner of the free strategy session. If you were listening to last week's episode, I gave you all a chance to win a free strategy session. There were so many entries that I had to pick three winners instead of just one. So congrats to Adam S., Freddie S., and Daryl G. I look forward to speaking with each of you and seeing what I can do to help you guys get some clarity and so that you can take meaningful steps towards success in your music careers. So again, thank you guys for listening. This was my treat to you. For listening and being so attentive and helping the show to grow. So now that that's out of the way, let's get right into the interview. All right, guys, I'm really excited about today's guest. He's an artist manager named Sam Fisher. Now, he's a self-described music business lifer, and he's been involved in the music business for nearly 30 years with areas or experience in all sorts of areas. Now, combined, his clients have sold nearly 500,000 albums and have had nearly 75 million streams to date. So I'm really excited about the conversation and the things that you guys are going to learn today. So please welcome to the Music Business Dreams podcast, Mr. Sam Fisher.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem.
I'm doing great, man. It's a beautiful Saturday here in Durham, North Carolina, where I spend most of my time when I'm not in Nashville or L.A. or wherever. But it's nice to have a quiet, calm, dry Saturday morning.
Right, definitely. And I'm in Raleigh, so I'm not too far.
That's what's up.
Yeah, man. So for those who may not be familiar with your career, why don't you give us a little overview?
Yeah, I've been in music literally probably my entire life. Most definitely my adult life. But one of my earliest memories was backstage at one of my dad's concerts. I think even back then I had some sort of dreams of being some sort of a mogul. You know, I was. My dad said I would walk around in my diaper and a T-shirt with a chewing gum cigar, right? It used to be these cigars that were made entirely of like chewing gum, like bubble gum or whatever. Uh-huh. And so I would hold it in my mouth and I would chew off a piece and, I'd kind of walk around bossing people around and stuff. I just can't remember a time in my life where music wasn't prominent. My birth mom divorced when I was, I want to say I was like eight, maybe 7 or 8 years old. And, but he remarried rather quickly and he married a gospel singer. So she comes into my life and she's singing all the time and she's traveling and she's doing that. And so that's pretty much all I've known. And, pretty early on, I think the first instrument I learned was saxophone. Then after that, was piano. I remember going to college and experiencing guitar for the first time. My roommate could play. Mm. And I remember making the comment to him that like, I think I'm going to learn how to play guitar. And he's like, why? And I was like, cause I can't lug a piano or saxophone all over campus. Yeah. Right. And so I remember like diving in. I ended up taking some classes, like I took classical guitar and jazz guitar in college, and sometime around then I started playing music live, like playing out. I want to say my first time I ever played out live, I was, gosh, it was maybe 17 18. And my parents came, so the funny thing is both my parents came to that, right? And so I think I'm like the man, right? I just crushed that open mic, man. Nobody can, you know, and, you know, I think I did something like, I think I covered a Chicago song. I did a Jamiroquai song, and then I did a song that I had written. And I was impressed, you know, I was like, yeah, no one can play this on guitar, you know, and I get off stage and I walk up to my parents and I go, so what y'all think? You're like, I'm expecting them to go, that's my son, my man, and throw me on the shoulders. And my dad goes, man, it's pretty good, man. I think you need to really lean in on the guitar lessons, you know, really work on some of your dexterity and you want to. And then my mom goes, and baby, it might be time for you to get some voice lessons. And I'm like, what? I'm your baby boy. That's the best you can do.
Man.
But that was, you know, that was just how they would drive me. It was always from a nurturing place, but my parents were always telling me, you know, you are amazing. You just have to work to get there. You know, and so it was never, you've already arrived. It was always like, okay, now what's the next step? Okay, what's the next step? You know,
right.
You know, my dad would, you know, I wanted pretty early on to be a musician. I kept saying, I'm going to play music. I'm going to do like you did, Dad. And he was like, nope, you're going to graduate high school first. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, and then I graduated high school, going to college. And I'm like, yeah, now I'm going to play music. And my dad's like, nope, you're going to graduate college first. I'm like, oh. So I would take 18 hours a semester. I would take summer classes. I would do whatever I could do to finish school. And I had enough credits to graduate early. And my guidance counselor or whatever gave me the option. She was like, well, you can stay another semester and get a second degree, because I was fairly close to a second degree. She's like, or you can stay a little longer, get an MBA or get like a master's or something like that. And I remember going home asking my dad, and I was like, hey, what do you think I should do? And he's like, yeah, why don't you go and get that second degree? And I was like, come on, man. I want to play music. You know, so I graduated college. I'm like, now I'm going to be a musician. And my dad would go, nah, you should get a job first. I was like, yes, sir. You know, and I think my first job was at a bank. I think I was a branch manager of a bank. And I was moonlighting. Like I would play shows. I would leave work, change clothes, put an earring in, because I had an earring back then, and I would go play shows like every night. And I would have to get up the next day, shave, take the earring out, put on a suit, and go to work. And right around, I would say 96, 97, I actually ended up doing all right. Like I sold like 1,000 units of this record I put out. And that was what I was like, you know, I might need to try to give this a full go, you know? And so that's when I really dove in, to try to be like a professional tour musician and the whole thing. And then I met this band named Weekend Excursion at the time, as I was in the middle of my own touring. And they had just also released Singer, and they were mixing their record when he quit.
Wow.
And the day I met them, the week I met them, they had a show planned that had already sold out. So they had a sold out show with no lead singer and a record that was finished with no lead singer. And so, so I go in, I audition, I played Marvin Gaye, a couple other songs, and they looked at me and they go, hey man, so we have guitars, so we don't need you to play guitar. And I'm like, what? I'm a classically trained, jazz trained guitarist. So why do you not need me to play? And it's like, well, we're like a rock band. We don't need you to do that. Like your chords are cool, but we don't do that. And so I was like, all right. So I became a front man kind of by default, really, because they just wanted me to sing in front of the band. They didn't need me to do the things I was good at. And, you know, if you go back, like, when you go back, like, I think one of the first outfits, the bands I played in was like this little jazz quartet. And I would sit on my amp behind everybody. Like, I didn't want to be seen. And so it was incredibly, what's the word? I would say it wasn't challenging, but the adrenaline that I felt going on stage in front of a band without anything to hide behind. I remember being like this combination of fear, anticipation, challenge, you know, I wouldn't say, I don't think I had the confidence, but I was incredibly fearless back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember walking on stage, man, and it was at, this is a venue called Legends in Boone, North Carolina. There was 800 people in the room. All of them knew every word to every song. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is the real. They're going to know if I make a mistake and or whatever. And I was like, you know what? Just own it. Just be you. Just own it. And that began like a pretty lengthy run of some incredible times for me. Like I got to see the world with that band. We toured all over the country, sold something like 30,000 records, selling merch every night, like signing autographs. You know, it was crazy moments where I'd be walking down the street and someone would walk up to me and ask for an autograph, right? I'm like in this mm-hmm. indie band and like I'm locally famous, right? And so, so that was a cool experience. And then, you know, that, you know, the band officially stopped touring in like 03, 04. And, you know, I tried to keep that flame alive, right? So I did like some solo stuff. I think I found a deal right around 05 with this, you know, pretty much with this kind of media mogul guy. Like he just had a whole bunch of money burning a hole in his pocket, started a record label, built out a studio with $200,000 or $300,000 worth of equipment. And he just signed about five or six of us. And we're like, now go in a room and make me rich. Go in a room, make me, you know, make me some records, make me rich. And he's, you know, he moved me down to Atlanta, Georgia. I did a record down there, and, you know, and, it just, I never really could recreate that initial magic I had when I was by myself before, mm-hmm. nor could I even reach what Weekend Excursion had done. And, it was right around then I was like, you know what? I started telling people I was semi-retired. The very first management client I ever got was in 07. And he was a kid like me, and he had gone to Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had become a very, pretty strong acquaintance of John Mayer at the time. And John Mayer had come from Berkeley and was an incredible, incredible guitar player, but he could craft a song. And I remember seeing the same thing in this other kid that I met. And I was like, hey man, let me help you out, you know? Mm-hmm. And, so I met with him, met with his dad, whole thing. And like we signed papers and I was like, I'm going to manage this kid. I had no clue what I was doing. I know how to be in a band, and I know how to be a solo artist, and I know how to play music. So how hard can it be?
Right.
And I think he fired me after 6 months because I couldn't book him enough shows. He's like, this is not working. We're going to go ahead and give you your last month's check, and we're just going to kind of go on our own. But that began kind of like my transition out of being the guy on stage to being the guy in the back of, you know, in the back corner, like making the moves, you know?
Right.
And you know, here we are. I mean, it's like 11 years later, and I'm happy to say that, you know, I get to earn a living doing this. And, you know, my life is probably just way out of my league, and I'm kind of undeserving of it, but she is, you know, she's kind of been the rock while I've tried to figure out really what I am and what my niche is and who I am as a manager. But,
right.
Yeah. But yes, I mean, that's my 10-minute music history, I guess.
Okay, cool. So I want to talk about, I guess, that transition from being the artist to kind of going more behind the scenes and management.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that, because I know you said you felt like you couldn't recreate that magic you had earlier in your career. But what was it about management that appealed to you? Because you could have gone into any other area of the business.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've come to know now, like I don't think I knew then, you know, but I always had this incredible sense of duty, right? It was one of those things like I have a responsibility as a musician, as an artist to give back, right? I always felt like, I mean, we're musicians. We're not doing anything, you know, world changing, right? But I do believe that art was created. You know, I think that, like, when God created the heavens and the earth, mm-hmm. in his mind, he knew all right, I'm about to create these humans and they're crazy. So I'm going to try to figure out a way to keep them sane and stable somewhat. And I believe art is part of that, right?
Mm.
You know, hopefully no Christians are going to call me a heretic by saying that. But I think that, I do think that, like, there's some sort of a responsibility to it. And so early on, it was really more me kind of getting out of the way and giving back. And like one of my first conversations with my wife at the time was, you know, like, I mean, I was like, man, I'm like 34 years old. This is crazy. I don't need to be out on stage jumping around and doing all this stuff. Like, you know, that's somebody else's job. I need to get out of the way and give them a chance. Like, it's like every show I take is a show that should have went to the next guy up.
Right.
And so in the beginning, it was that. It was like, how can I support someone else coming behind me and give up that slot to them as well, you know? And so,
mm-hmm.
But I think it's kind of morphed from there, you know, it's a little bit of the same thing, right? Where now I'm more of a, you know, I have become somewhat of a gatekeeper now, right? Like, you know, I work at this fantastic company that has been in business for like 25 years. And when people see, when they see Sam Fisher, Deep South Entertainment, like they, you know, they're like, oh wow, Deep South, that guy must know what he's talking about. And,
right.
You know, so there's more of a, like, I gotta be careful, right? I can't just let everything out into the world because, you know, people now are going to think, oh, he knows what he's talking about, right? Deep South vouches for me, and then if I go vouch for something else, basically I'm saying Deep South is vouching for this.
Right.
And I think there's a weight and a responsibility to that. And, you know, and so now I've kind of taken it to this other level where I'm like, I am a curator of what, at least in my own little sphere of influence, I'm a curator of what those people listen to. And I can't, that cannot be something that can't be frivolous. You know, I'm not the guy who goes, oh, that's going to make a lot of money. That should be released. I'm always looking at a song going, will this song connect with someone else's experience and help them put words, you know, put words to what they have lived?
Right.
In a way that's visceral, right? Like, will it connect and will it drive this person toward, you know, toward love and good deeds? Will it drive them toward, you know, pursuing a dream? Will it drive them, you know, to apologize to something? Like, and so, you know, so it's now, that's kind of what it's become, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you ask my mom, she would say it's because I was a firstborn. She's mm-hmm. like, you firstborns, you think everybody's your little brother, you know? And
right.
I mean, I think there's some of that. There's some of that too. But in this day and age now, man, like I read somewhere where it's something like 10,000 songs released every day or something crazy like that.
Wow.
Or uploaded to Spotify, I think. That's a lot of songs. And I'm not saying that, like, I'm not saying all songs are bad, and I'm not saying that every song deserves to be heard either. But there should be some thought behind it. There should be some people there that are trusted, and the people who are trusted should take that seriously. You know, because people just can't hear 10,000 songs every day. You have to help them figure out what is, you know, what is good and what's, you know, what's going to really enhance their lives and it's going to help them get through another day or go to work and not drive themselves crazy or, you know, something
right.
they can just retreat into when they go to the gym, you know? And, so yeah, I mean, I'm sure too. I mean, I'm still, you know, I still got a lot more life to live. And I guess, you know, I'm sure that will change a little bit or it'll evolve a little bit more. And I'll probably have a real clear head when I'm 75 and too old to do it, you know?
Right.
But that's what's motivating to me now.
Okay, cool. So let's talk about that in-between period. Well, from then to now, because you got your first management client in 2007 and you said it didn't work out because you weren't booking them enough shows. Maybe you didn't have enough clout among other gatekeepers. So how did you go from that point to now working at one of the premier artist management companies?
Some people would say it's my sheer perseverance and, you know, just a will thing. You know, I have always been known as that guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of driven by, I'm driven by no. Like, I'm the guy who says, thanks for the chip, and I put it on my shoulder, and then it becomes, like, the engine for me. But, and then that worked. You know, when I was little, I told my mom I wanted to be a pro tennis player. And she dismissed it. She said, oh, that's cute, baby. Just go, whatever. And I was like, what? I'll show you, you know?
Right.
And so that drove me. So I ended up playing college tennis at a Division I school and played a couple of pro tournaments. I didn't become a pro player per se, but I did get paid to play tennis for a summer, you know? And, so that's always been the thing. So, but honestly, man, I think it's more luck. Really. Like, I mean, and fate and, you know, or what other words? Kismet, right? It's like where I just stuck around long enough and fought hard enough and was pleasantly persistent long enough for everything to align and I get an opportunity, you know? You know, I ended up at Deep South. So I met Dave Rose in 96, and it was in Atlanta. He had just started Deep South Records, or Deep South, I think it was called Deep South Records at the time. And, you know, he wasn't much older than me. I think he might have been 5-6 years older than me. And he had a, you know, backpack, and he was walking around with sampler discs, and he was trying to, you know, whatever. I think I had a showcase down at this Atlanta kind of music festival thing. And so he and I had known each other for 20 some years, right? And so, you know, I just left a management firm, in Nashville, and I was feeling a bit disenfranchised. Like, I was like, you know, man, this maybe manager's not for me. So I think I don't know what I'm going to do next. I started talking to some of my label friends. You know, I was seriously chasing like an A&R job or a marketing manager job at a label. And I just was like, hey, man, let's grab some breakfast. And it was more like, hey, let's catch up. I want to see how your life's going, how things are going. Nothing more. Like, I had no other ideas. So I sat down, we eating breakfast. And I think in the middle of a venting session, right, I was just kind of lamenting, you know, shady managers, and lamenting, like, people only caring about the money and not caring about the content. And then the conversation, in the middle of that sentence with him, I switched the conversation to safety and comfort and familial kind of, you know, ethos, right? And I was like, man, I was like, sometimes I just feel like, you know, like LeBron James. I'm not that I'm LeBron James, so please don't any of your listeners to think that's what I did. But I would say, I was like, I just want to play for the home team. I want to play where people know me. I want to be with people who understand me, respect me, have seen me work. I don't want to keep going to every different place and having to prove myself all over again. Mm-hmm. And he goes, so what do you mean? I was like, I don't know. I was like, I like this, man. I was like, if I'm going to make some dude money, I would rather be you. I've known you for 20 years. You know, but when I said it, I had no thoughts about, I'm going to go work for Deep South. I was in my mind, I was like, I'm getting out of management. I'm going to go back into business. I'm going to work at a label. You know, I worked at Yep Rock Records and Red Eye Distribution for like 3 years.
Mm.
So in my mind, I was like, I'm going to do that again. So I'm talking to Dave, and it's more of just, he's my homie, and I'm just telling him, I'm just being open and honest.
Right.
And he sits back, and he puts his foot down. He sits back in his chair, and he goes, are you serious? And I was like, what do you mean? Well, yeah, I'm serious. What are you talking about? He's like, if you're serious about joining us, man, he's like, I will make that my priority. And I was like, excuse me again? And it was like this flame lit in me almost immediately, because I was like, holy crap, I never thought about that. Like, it never occurred to me to go work for Deep South, right? It was more like he was a friend, and I was just telling him. And so that is a fake thing, right? Because
right.
I fast forward now, and he, you know, Deep South is growing by leaps and bounds, and we've got some great management clients, and you know, they are they're reallocating resources, and they're making the management firm like a priority. And it was something that he was in his brain, he was kind of, you know, workshopping, like, how am I going to expand the management firm? How am I going to grow the management firm? And I sit down at the table and go, if I work with another management company ever again, it will be yours. And so it was like, so that, like, that's just fate. And it's just me sticking around long enough for that to happen. And it is a core philosophy with me when I manage my clients. And they'll all tell you, like, I say from the beginning, you will never skip a step in the process. As even if you jump ahead, you will have to go back and complete those steps, right? So, you know, you find a great singer and they sign to a major label. That major label still has to develop them. They still have to know how to tour. They still have to know who they are. They still have to write a million songs until they get the right one. And they, you know, and so they never skip it. And so what I tell my clients, I say, it's not who gets there first. It's not who gets there fastest. It's not who gets there loudest. It's the person who's there last. Mm. I said, you just keep going. You finish. It's like, and you go until you can't go anymore, but you never stop with more left, right? And that I think in and of itself has been what I am, you know, and so I hung around long enough for Deep South to say, we need to recommit to our management firm and grow it and build it. I think that's going to be a great, great thing for us. And I take a breakfast with them and now I'm there. Right. Wow. And I would say that's like it is with everything. Like a story I tell sometimes. I remember stealing $3 in gas to get to a gig. And I guess statute of limitations is over now. So, you know, but I ended up paying the money back, right? I had to go to this gig like in Atlanta Beach or something, and I had no gas, like none. And I was like driving, and I was like, I got another 45 miles to go, and it has been on E for 20 miles. Wow. And I saw a gas station on the side of the road, and I had no money in my pocket. But I was going to get paid like $150. I had CDs and T-shirts. I was like, I'll have merch money. I can pay it back when I come back. And you know, so I was like, I could go in and ask, but he's going to say no. Nobody says yes, you can have $2 in gas. You know, right. So I did. I pumped $3 worth of gas into my car that I calculated would be enough to get me to the gig and back.
Mm.
And drove off. And then I came back and I slid a $5 bill into the door with a note wrapped around it. I'm sorry I took $3 worth of gas. Here's the money back. I don't even know if they ever, they probably pocketed the money. But like, that has always been my mentality. There is no, you can't. It's just you haven't or won't. So I would say that kind of is where I go. But, you know, but in between 07 and, you know, and now, you know, I made mistakes. I lost clients after killing myself to get them to where they need to be. Right. You know, I'm proud to say that, like, most of the clients I work with, they made more money with me than they did without me, and they were better when I left. I don't think I ever worked with a client after that first one that could leave and say, man, Sam just wasn't doing it for me, man. He just wasn't getting it done. That was never the case. It was always like, well, I'm starting to go in a different direction, or maybe our personalities didn't mesh, or, you know, we wanted something different. We didn't like that path. Those are all valid reasons, but it was never, I didn't help them succeed. And I'm proud of that. You know, but those are tough. It's tough because when you manage a client and when that client finds a manager, it is almost as deep a relationship as like a long-term, like romantic relationship. You know that person, you know the person's finances, you know their family, you know, you come and break bread in their house. I had a client leave me, you know, not too long ago. And like that dude was sleeping in my house. Every single time he came to town, he stayed in my house. He was part of my family, but practically. So the day he called me and said, hey man, we decided we're going to go in a different direction. Oh my God, that hurt. That stung so much that it almost changed me. And so, you know, so it does require a certain level of, you know, get knocked down, get back up again, figure it out, you know, keep going. You got to keep going. That was always the thing. Like, what's your goal? All right, well, don't stop till you get it. Like, there is no, you're not going to. It's just that you haven't yet. And you know, thankfully I'm able to still do that, you know? And, you know, I think that would be my advice to anybody trying to go into management is you will fail, you will lose artists, you will get fired, you'll get stiffed. You know, I had an artist, I got a, you know, I secured a pretty sizable deal for this artist. Mm-hmm. And when it came time to pay me commissions for it, he was like, I'm not going to do that. The agent did that. I was like, no, I orchestrated that whole thing. The agent just worked for me to do it. He's like, no, man, I don't, if you make me pay you that, I'm probably going to sue you. And I remember being like frustrated, upset about that. You know, but you know, what do I do? Do I quit or keep going? So I kept going, you know? So, wow.
So for someone who, you know, starting out wanting to be an artist manager, what tips would you give them for making those initial connections that they would need in order to make things happen for their artist?
The number one thing that these people need to know, like anybody going into the management business, is that the music business, while it is a pretty closed off fraternity, we love new people. Like, we want new blood. We want people to come in. We want the curious and the ambitious. And so, they just need to know that, like, every door is open. I have cold called executive VPs of major labels. Like, you don't know me. So-and-so gave me your information. I just want to reach out and see if I can pick your brain for 15 minutes. Or can I buy you coffee? Or can I swing by the office and bring you some donuts and just ask you a few questions? And I've never gotten to know, ever.
Wow.
One day, like, you know, maybe I'll be known for this story, but I remember emailing an A&R. Like, he was the head of an A&R, and I wanted to get my artist signed to his label, and I emailed him and said that we had a mutual friend. I didn't tell him who it was. I think a mutual friend told me, I would probably, you and I would probably get along together. And I thought it'd be cool to just sit down and have coffee with you. Would you like to meet? I never told him who the mutual friend was because there wasn't one. And, but we did end up clicking. Like, we did get along. Like, we sat down, we talked. Turns out we were about the same age. We liked the same things. We had a similar background. Like, he was an artist who had become a songwriter who had gone into label work. And you know, and it was like, you know, but it was the quickest yes. It was like, oh, yeah, no problem, man. What's a good day for you? And I think early on, a lot of managers are afraid to do that. They're like, I don't have a clout. I don't have a client. I'm a nobody. They're just not going to talk to me. And that is the exact opposite of that. You know, I went from a nobody in Nashville to, you know, I text messages with people who, you know, who have platinum records, you know, and it started with, I just want to sit down and pick your brain. Is that okay? So, I think that's the number one thing. I think a close second to that is never take no for an answer. You got to do it the right way. You know, my boss is, you know, the owner of Deep South is probably one of the best I've ever seen at it. He is incredibly respected in several different major music markets. And everyone says the same thing. Like, that Dave Rose is one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. And he is, you know, he's persistent. He works hard. He's kind. He's great, grateful. Like, they say all the good things you want to hear about your boss, you know, and I want to tailor myself to that, but that's what you have to be. You have to say, I'm really sorry for bothering you again, but I would love to sit down and see, you know, whatever. And then when you get a no, you go, all right, appreciate the no. Thank you so much for hanging out. And then be able and willing to come back again. I know you said no last time, but let me present it to you in a different way, right? Mm-hmm. And see, so those two things, I think if a person who goes into management sticks to those two principles and hold them close, you know, then, you know, you'll see some success. You know, all of us want to be Scooter, right? Or Irving, Azov. Like, we all want to be those guys. You know, but fact of the matter is, like, there's some incredible managers out there that people don't know, you know, who are doing incredibly well, you know? Like, you talk to, you know, Mo, right? Who, he manages, you know, the Marshmallow, right? Mm-hmm. And he tells stories like where he's like, bro, you couldn't tell me though. Like I will just keep asking until someone tells me yes. Mm-hmm. And I will keep going. I will keep walking up to somebody that doesn't know me and be like, hey, you ever hear my guy? Have you heard my guy? You ever hear my guy? You know, it would be great. My guy should come do this thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think that, I mean, and really you learn and you grow. That is from doing it. Like there are management classes you can take and stuff like that. And, you know, you can learn from that. I'm not telling people not to go get an education. I think that's important.
Right.
But there's no substitute for being cool and never taking no.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay, cool. So, you said perseverance is a big thing. Not taking no for an answer, of course. And then just going in with the understanding that, okay, there's something here for me, right? Like there's, I don't have anything right now, but there's always something to be gained. And the world doesn't have something against me, right? Because I think a lot of people go into it like that. Like, okay, I'm some nobody. I'm in North Carolina, right? It's not like a big music town or traditionally anyway. And I don't know anyone, but I've got this artist and I believe in them, but I don't know anyone. So who's going to take my word for it? Right. And so it's interesting because a lot of people feel like they have to move in order to get those connections, or they might just have to find the next Beyonce and nothing less in order to make progress. What would you say to someone who feels that way?
It is, I'm also pretty brash and unfiltered, so forgive me if anybody thinks this, but, I think that's kind of the coward's way out, man. Like, I think if you don't believe in yourself to your core, who you are, it's never going to work. Even when, you know, you could sign Beyonce or, you know, Logic or, you know, Selena Gomez. You could sign somebody who when they move through town, they increase the financial, you know, they stir economic growth in places that they go. Taylor right. Swift is in the industry, right? You could have that. And if you don't believe in yourself to your core, if you're afraid of who you are and afraid of what you can do and afraid of what your value is, you will always be chasing it. Like you won't be happy with Taylor Swift. You'll be like, man, you know, you'll have this weird kind of cynical, bitter chip on your shoulder. And you know, that just removes the joy from it. So I think people who say that they need that, I would tell them, I said, no, you don't. Like I've managed a bunch of nobodies who stayed nobodies. But I kept it moving. You know what I mean? Like, and the thing is like somebody's were nobodies once, you know, at one point. Justin Bieber was just some kid who can sort of sing and play his guitar. You know,
right.
Scooter was like, someone told Scooter he couldn't do it. And Scooter was like, watch, and did it. And then when he said, well, Scooter, you can't do it twice. Scooter was like, I'm going to do it. Not only am I going to do it twice, I'm going to do it twice, and I'm going to have someone do it at the same time. I'm going to break two different artists in a different way at the same time. I'm going to show you, you know. And you got to have that. That's like, I don't think you can be a great manager if you don't have that self-belief. Because you have to walk – think about it. You have to walk into a room with someone else and look them in the face and say, I can help you reach whatever you're trying to reach. I can. And that's like – that's crazy, right? Like, it takes a certain amount of ego and self-belief to do that. And I think if you go into the game going, well, I'm going to need this in order for someone to believe in me, then you probably aren't going to make it.
Mm. Good point. So I want to talk about, like, the artist-to-manager relationship. Because like you said, it's like a long-term relationship, whether it's romantic or not, of course, but it's like you go into the situation and you may see something in someone that they do or don't see in themselves, right? But you guys, just because you're two different people, so you've got two different goals, right? Whether they're financial or whether you just want to see them on a certain stage or whatever. And you guys aren't always going to agree. How do you manage that relationship being that, okay, of course, you work for the artist. So technically, whatever the artist says goes, but how is it that you're able to communicate, you know, what you feel is in their best interest and don't walk away from it feeling like, you know, I lost this battle or whatever?
Yeah, well, the key is that last phrase, right? I would even argue that my marriage has helped me be a better manager. You know, in a marriage, it's for better, for worse, or death do you part. And so no matter how big an argument or no matter how deep a disagreement I have with my wife, I can't just up and leave, right? You know? And so it gives me a certain freedom in a relationship that I can just up and leave if I want to. Right. And so you have to be 100% honest in that type of relationship. And it is weird, right? Because it's like, you know, especially at my level, like now when I walk into a room to manage an artist, I'm coming in most of the time, I'm coming in kind of in a position of influence, you know? So when, I just signed on a new client. We haven't announced it yet. It'll be a couple of months before we do it, but, but he's got some things going on, right? He's doing some things. He's like connected a little bit, you know, or whatever. But when we sat down to talk, he was like, man, I just really like what you do. I like what Deep South is up to, man. And I think we can work together. We can do this thing. And so there's this, in the moment, like he's pursuing me. Like, so I'm in this situation where it's like, you know, well, we're not equals, you know, for no better way to say it. And, but he's absolutely going, hey, I want you to come work for me and manage my stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I have to play that role. And so, you know, I am of the belief, that the greatest managers are the ones who completely like slide into the background, right? Mm-hmm. You have to do that. You have to have a mindset of I'm going to serve the music. I'm going to serve the client's goals and their ideals. And I'm going to represent them as their like ambassador to the music business to the best of my ability. So I look at it more like that. Like when, it's like this symbiotic, mutually beneficial relationship. And I also think that disagreement is a big deal, you know, and I'm known for that. Like I have looked my artist right in the face in front of the record label and said, nah, man, I don't think I see it that way. I think you might need to rethink that, you know? If I want to boil it all down, I would say this. You can't get trust without conflict, and you can't get conflict unless there's implicit trust. Mm-hmm. And so you have to come at it from that perspective of, I'm here to serve you, but don't get it wrong. I have the skills necessary to serve you in this role, so you have to listen to what I'm trying to tell you, because it is coming from a good place. It's like a president and his advisors, or a CEO and the COO relationship, you know. You have to have somebody there to look at your blind spots and to help you, you know, see obstacles that you may not have seen. And so it's that implicit trust, that mutual respect, and the managers, basically the manager being able to say, I will sacrifice me for the sake of this. You're like serving the dream, the music. You gotta put it outside of the personality. You gotta put it outside of the people, right? So one person will go, oh, well, so so-and-so manages that person. So like, Sam manages that guy, so Sam's the boss. But not really, right?
Right.
And no more, as my client will say, oh, he's my manager, he works for me. No, not really. Like, I'm here to take your songs, take who you are, and develop you to a place where you can impact society and culture in a certain way, right?
Right.
And so that's what I'm serving, and you have to serve that too. And if you can't or don't want to, or if you, if this is like an employee-employer relationship, then it probably won't work. And I don't think I would work well in that situation, to be honest. So I have said no to some artists in that situation. I was managing a guy once. He was making, I mean, he was projecting $1.5 million in revenue. And he had just had an incredibly successful, you know, run, and he was doing some really cool things. And he told me he was trying to, he's like, look, man, I want to kind of redo what our relationship is. And he said, I see you as more of like an executive assistant. Now, it was a misspeak on his part, right? He said the wrong thing. It was a misstatement. But what he really meant was, I want you to be an employee. I'm going to build the team, and I want you to work for me. I'm going to call all the shots. I'm going to do all the things. And I was like, well, then I'm not the guy for you. Like, I just bounced. And I come to realize later on that I'm like, well, hey, I probably should have taken that. I probably should have said, yeah, let's do that, because, you know, in on paper, my role would have looked like, oh yeah, he manages the team, but his boss is this guy, and that's exactly what it is as a manager. But in the moment, I got a little bit in my own feelings and my ego got involved, and I was like, man, I'm not going to be an employee. We either going to be partners in this or we're not. When in actuality, what he was saying is, hey, I want you to come inside, and I want you to be beside all these other people who are chasing the same dream, and I want you to just be a part of a greater team. But on the surface, when I heard that statement, I was like, no, this will not work if I'm your employee. I have to be able to speak to you from a place of autonomy and a place of wisdom and knowledge and experience. I need to be able to speak freely in that situation, and you hear it. And if I'm just your employee, that's not going to work, because there's an implied pressure to consent in that, right? If I'm just an employee and he doesn't like what I say, he can fire me. So then I'm probably not going to be as unfiltered as I should be.
Right.
And like I said, in my marriage, my wife has this uncanny ability of making sure I never get too big a head. She's kind of never really that impressed with me, right? And but what if she worked for me, though? Or what if she was some way subservient to me instead of just my equal partner? Well, then she would have to say, whenever I come home and say, hey, so I'm going to do that, she would have to agree with it, right? Or I'd put her in a place. It was the same thing in a management relationship. And so, you know, I think if I was going to boil that down, I would say that there has to be a common goal and a common purpose, and both people have to be serving that. And neither one should be serving the other. It should be, what are we chasing? That's what we're going to do. So when I tell them, like, a client, like, if that's what you want, you need to do this. Right? Like, if you're a pop artist, you're like, I really want to be a hip hop artist. I'm not going to say, okay, cool, let's go. Let's just leave your label and let's just go be a hip hop artist. That's a dumb thing to do. I would be giving him bad advice.
Right.
You know, but I would say, so if you want to be a hip hop artist, well, then let's find out what those steps are. Let's take those steps. Leaving your label is not the right step. Stay here. And because I'm serving the goal, not him, you know,
right.
Or her. Yeah.
So you've been in the business for a while. I mean, when you came into the business, you know, the labels were pretty much responsible for all the talent. There wasn't so many indie acts out, or at least not on a mainstream level. How do you feel the business has changed, or how have you had to change your management style since, you know, it's, you know, there's things like CD Baby and TuneCore, and it seems like everyone can be on iTunes and stuff like that.
So I'm going to give you a two-part answer on this. So for me personally, I'm actually a product of the, I'm a product of the new paradigm. I was an indie artist, worked for an indie record label, toured, did all the things, learned how to craft a song, learned how to, you know, develop a stage presence, all those things. I was, in a sense, an artist development guy who manages artists. And when I started managing, that was at its, it's the infancy, right? Like 07, 08, when I started managing artists, the music business was at it's probably its lowest point. Like it was, I think that year it made something in the neighborhood of, you know, $1 or $2 billion in 1 year or $2 billion mm-hmm. in 1 year. And it was, you know, they like artists, I mean, record labels were like just mass firing people. There was mass consolidation. Like we went from 7 labels to 3 that year or 4 mm-hmm. that year. You know, and everything was constricting in the business. And so it was like all of that kind of fell on managers. It fell on the artists and it fell on the managers to do it themselves. And that's when CD Baby came into its own. And then, so man, I'm so sorry. I got a little frog in my throat. But, that's when TuneCore came along and there's all these things were coming around, all these tools, like the internet just blew open everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really have to change, you know, my personal ethos and my professional strategy because I was kind of learning on the go anyway. And I was trying to figure out how I fit in this new normal. But I will tell you I had some, like my mentors, like one of my mentors was, managed Hootie and the Blowfish during the Diamond record, 25 million albums sold, couldn't pay the record of the radio stations to quit playing the hit. Like he was around for that. And so he had to figure that out. He had to figure out, okay, now how do I fit now? Cause in this new paradigm, a label's not going to take some artist that's not developed yet unless they trust the manager to help develop it. And a lot of times A&R is not even structured that way, you know, and you look at labels now, it's like, it's kind of driven quarterly now, right? Like mm-hmm. they plan their releases based on how they're going to hit their numbers. So, you know, there's numbers people running everything. And, you know, so you don't have a lot of record men out there. And I think a lot of those record men, instead of going to the labels, have basically gone into management. One of the best ears that I've ever worked with, was a kid who was a drummer in a band of an artist I managed. He ended up coming to intern for me. He went from interning with me to starting a management company with me. And to this day, I would say that there isn't anybody with a better gut instinct and a better ear than him. Like he can hear a hit in the roughest of diamonds and intuitively knows exactly how to get an artist where they need to be to put that out there. But he's not at a label, right? He's like, and he would be somewhat limited and inhibited at a label because they would say, I know that's amazing. That could be the next icon, but we have to make sure we make quota this year, right? You know, this quarter, we have to make sure we make this or stock prices are going to drop or this or that. You're going to have to drop that artist. And so it's very singles driven. You know, you have, you know, the burn rate on a song now is maybe 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be 8 months. You know, remember back in the day when a single would hit the radio, it would be on the radio for a year.
Right.
Like, oh gosh, quit playing that song, right? And you know, I think they played Happy for like 13 months, heavy rotation every hour, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you have Spotify, and kids will listen to In My Feelings by Drake, close to 20 million times, 20, 30 million times. And they're like, okay, that's cool, I'm done.
Right.
And then radio goes, hey, we're going to play the new one by Drake. It's called In My Feelings. My daughter rolls her eyes when she sees that. And she goes, God, why do they play all the old music, is what she says. But it's like a song that's like 3 weeks old.
Right.
And so managers now have become this extended A&R. There's this extended arm of a record label. And so for me as a manager now, what I've tried to do is – develop relationships and network and open lines of communication and stuff. And so I don't necessarily pitch my label friends, artists,
mm-hmm.
as I just kind of invite them, like I kind of invite them into my development process. I work with this kid named Brandon Murphy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember telling this label A&R about Brandon Murphy 2 years before he signed a deal with that label, and I never even said his name. I didn't tell that label his name for 18 months. So he goes, he says, hey, man, he goes, man, good seeing you, man. Thanks for coming out to the showcase, yada, yada, yada. And I said, yeah, man, no problem, man. It's good to hang out with you. Hey, I got something for you. And he goes, yeah? What is it? And I go, I say, he sings better than he raps, and he raps better than he sings. And I was like, and he's probably one of the better rappers there are. I was like, he does spoken words. He plays two instruments. He's incredible on stage. Good looking kid. You will never hear a voice like it. Like I said all that. And he goes, let me add him. And I was like, he ain't ready yet. And he goes, okay. Let me know when he's ready. 3 months later, I go, I said, ooh, let me show you. Let me send you something. And I send him a little snippet of a song. He goes, who is this? I said, this is the kid I told you about. When do I get to meet this kid? Not yet. He ain't ready yet. I did that for like 18 months. And then I finally said his name at a lunch. And he remembered. Because from the beginning, he was like, he was in on the process. Mm. He said, what are you working on, Sam? And he said, yeah, remember that kid I was telling you about? Yeah, man, it's good, man. I got him doing some shows. And I got him writing some songs. He's out in L.A. doing some stuff. And I got him doing this, whatever. He said, yeah, man, when am I going to meet the kids? Yeah, he ain't ready yet. And so by the time he heard his name, he kind of knew. He's like, you just told me his name. I was like, I did. He said, is he ready now? Almost. I remember him sending me a happy birthday, or a happy New Year's message, right? He goes, happy New Year's, fam. I was like, happy New Year's, bro. I hope you're having a blast. He goes, when am I going to meet Brandon? Is what he said. He actually used his nickname. I mean, Brandon has a nickname, but he used his nickname. And I was like, not yet. So we'd put out a record at that point. This kid was touring. He was doing all the things. We were putting it together, right? And then we produced this mixtape. He put together this mixtape or whatever. And that was the first time it turned into a real pitch. And I called him and I said, I'm going to send you something. Remember that kid I was telling you about? And he goes, yeah, how's he doing? I was like, well, he just gave me a mixtape. We're about to put this mixtape out and it is fire. You need to hear it. And I was like, man, I'm telling you, this kid could change things. And he, in the call, he goes, so it sounds like you're pitching to me. I was like, one could call this a pitch. He goes, when do I get to meet him? What he said. I said, and he hadn't even heard the songs. So I sent him the song. He listened to them. He called me within like a day. It was like, hey, I want him to come in and play to the team. Bring him in, whatever. But that to me is what it is now. It's not a, this is not a thing where you walk in and the label goes, we got it from here. And you're just kind of managing the money, right? It is, you are just as much A&R as A&R is. And the A&R just takes what you've done to that point and packages it, puts it together. You know, I tell my artists, they're like crinkle cut french fries, right? Like you have to be unique as a crinkle cut french fry because everybody makes them, right? Mm. So are you going to be a Nathan's crinkle cut french fry? Are you Arita? You know, are you the store brand? What sets you apart? Like, how do you do that? And I think that's what labels do now. They go, okay, I know where the holes are in the market. I know how to position this thing there. I guess a friend of mine who works at Atlantic, he's been developing an artist now for 5 years. And I remember asking him, like, he works for Atlantic, but he manages this artist on the side. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, man, you never sign any other artists? And he goes, no, not until I break this one. And that's the attitude now. He's like managing this kid. This kid's got 40 million streams on Spotify. It's already played on Jimmy Kimmel and is touring the world. And he's like, he ain't broke yet. Once I break him and he's like world famous, I'm going to sign another artist. And, you know, and I think that that's your attitude you got to have in management, which means that you have to be willing to eat ramen noodles. You know, share a Airbnb bedroom with your artist. You know, like early on in my career, man, I was financing a monthly trip to Nashville for a week with gig money. Like I was just trying to figure out how I can put two pennies together so I could get to Nashville and live there for a week. And walk around and meet people and learn and do all, you have to do that now as a manager. Because the paydays just aren't there. Like you know, the biggest advance I've gotten with the artist I've worked with is 150 grand. I remember when it used to be 10 times that. Mm. But they're more like in the $15,000 to $20,000 range now. So you don't get it. You don't even make your money back when your artist signs with a label, you know? So you have to really be of the mindset that, like, this is a long haul, and we're going to do it to a right, and then we're going to call the label and say, help put this to the market, you know?
Right.
So,
right.
Definitely. Wow. So you and I could talk for hours, clearly. this has been great. I've learned a lot, and I know that our listeners have learned quite a bit just from having you here. Before we wrap this up, was there anything you've got going on that you wanted to let us know about or for us to check out?
I would definitely go check out Brandon Murphy. Like, he's an interesting kid when you look at talent. You know, I'm really excited about him. Like, he can sing like Charlie Puth, and has the skill and the ability to rap like a, you know, like a Logic or G-Eazy or Mac Miller. Like, he's a white kid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not going to be that guy who's like, yeah, I'm of the culture, right? He's not that guy. He's kind of an amalgam of all of it, right? He was raised in this small little rural town in Georgia. He went to a predominantly black school. He grew up listening to Tupac and Bone Thugs and Tim McGraw and Faith Hill and, you know, all the pop records of the day. And so he has become what I believe is a bit of the prototype of the genreless artist. You know, like, you got your John Bellions, you got your Childish Gambinos, you got those guys like that who kind of just kind of blend genres. To them, you know, Childish Gambino will put out a country record next week and won't think nothing of it.
Right.
Right. And then he'll sing on a record, and then he'll do funk on a record, and then people don't know that Childish Gambino can spit fire and is one of the best freestylers there are out there. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so Brandon has kind of represents that whole new guard, right? He can, you know, so you'll hear a song from him, and he'll, you know, he's got this incredible falsetto, and he'll do all this crazy stuff that you're like, wow, that sounds like Charlie Puth, you know. And then he'll rap his own 16-bar bridge on another one of his tracks, just over trap. He'll sing over a trap beat and then rap the bridge, you know.
Mm.
And, you know, he'll sing rap like Drake, you know, and then he'll go over here and do something kind of smooth out, like, you know, like a John Legend type of vibe, right? And, you know, so I'm really excited about him. It's tough because, you know, it's hard to know how to market a guy like that. You know, you can't just pick one audience and go, you know, because you're not going to get you're not going to get everything, right? And so,
right.
So I'm really excited about him. You know, Deep South has a young lady named Lainey Wilson. She's 22 now, 23. Mm-hmm. Incredible songwriter, incredible spirit. She calls her style of country bell bottom country, and phenomenal voice, and her stage presence is other level. And she just signed a deal over at BBR Records in Nashville, and you know, and so we're all in the building. We're all incredibly excited about her future. You know, so those are the two I think that I would say they're on deck, right? Like they're both early in their deal. They've got records coming out. Brandon Murphy's going to drop his EP in 2 weeks. And it's fire. Like, you're gonna hear everything on that. You're gonna hear some trap. You're gonna hear some rap. You're gonna hear some just straight up pure pop. You know, you're gonna hear, you know, some really cool urban, like, rhythmic stuff. You're gonna hear some Charlie Puth, some Justin Timberlake. He's all over the map, and it's still incredibly cohesive. And he's going on tour this fall. He's actually playing in Raleigh in October. We're gonna do like a small little release show in October at a Deep South the Bar. So, I'm excited, man. And, you know, we got some bigger things coming. We just haven't announced anything yet, but there's a lot bubbling under for us, over at Deep South. And we're really excited about the future.
Okay, cool. I'll be at that show in October. And, I wanted to, let's wrap up, but thank you so much for, you know, coming and being on the show, being so candid, being so open, and sharing your experience to help the artists and other aspiring managers that are out here and that are a part of the listenership. So I really just appreciate you being on the show, man.
Ben, thank you for having me. You know, it's, I mean, you're in the same curation business as me, and you selected me to come on the show and just tell my story and stuff. Like, you know, that I'm incredibly honored and grateful for that. You could have chosen so many other people, and thank you for allowing me to talk to your listeners, and I really appreciate what you're doing. So, you know, you hang in there, you keep fighting too, because we need a lot more of you too. So,
well, thank you, man. Thank you. And that's going to do it for today's episode of Music Business Dreams. Now, if you have listened all the way to this point, we are over an hour in. So thank you. I really appreciate it. I hope this conversation was helpful. I'm super grateful to Sam for being as open and as candid as he was about his experiences. And again, I hope they really help you on your journey to success in the music business. Hey, if you want to stay connected with us, please do so. There are so many ways. You can join the Indie Club on Facebook. You can follow us on YouTube, on Twitter, on all social media. We post new articles to our blog every Monday. There's a new video on our YouTube channel every Monday and Friday. And of course, this podcast comes out every week. Also, please leave a rating and a review. If you're listening in iTunes, on SoundCloud, wherever you're listening, please leave us a rating. Tell us how you're doing. Tell me how you feel honestly. I don't care if you give me 3 stars. Just tell us why. I'd love to hear from you, and I'll talk to you guys soon. Peace.